Good morning, everyone. Okay, so let us continue where we left off yesterday. So we are looking at the sutta on the two kinds of thoughts, and we have seen how the Buddha-to-be, before the Buddha's awakening, how he kind of divides his thinking into thoughts that are useful, thoughts that help on the path, and then thoughts that are unhelpful or kind of go in the wrong direction. And then once you have classified your thoughts in that way, you have understood what is unwholesome, what is wholesome, what is helpful, what is unhelpful, well then you have to have strategies for developing some of those thoughts and for overcoming the bad ones. So that is kind of the idea here. And, you know, already this idea of understanding that certain things are unwholesome, whereas other things are positive or skillful or whatever, that already is quite hard actually. Because most people, they tend to think of just the sensual thoughts or sensuality as not being really a problem. Yeah, that's kind of how the world looks at these things. Of course, it's not a big problem, but it is a problem on the spiritual path if you want to become peaceful and all of these kind of things. So just that contemplation of understanding, the distinction between wholesome and unwholesome is quite profound for the majority of people in the world. But of these three kinds of thought, we have the thoughts of ill will, we have the thoughts of harming, the thoughts of sensuality. The most problematic ones are the thoughts of ill will, right? Because they are the ones that cause the most problems, the most obviously unwholesome in the world, that lead to all kind of issues in society and interpersonally and all of these kind of things. So if you're going to focus on anything, I would recommend you to focus on that. And the Buddha says that overcoming ill will is relatively easy. Yeah, it is not super duper easy, but it is fairly easy, especially compared to sensuality, which is much more tricky because it's harder to see that it is a problem in the first place. So overcoming ill will is really a good place to start, and learning how to deal with that, overcoming some of those issues. I think we all have a sufficient motivation to overcome that. So that's useful. So it's relatively easy, and it's also very destructive. So it's kind of a doubly good reason for dealing with that. So we're also going to have a look a little bit more at sensuality, because sensuality has the same problems ultimately as ill will. What is interesting about all these various hindrances and defilements of the mind is that the root defilement, the root problem, is actually our attachment and desires in the sensory world. Ill will, all the other kind of problems in the mind, the five hindrances, they actually all stem really from that. And that's kind of interesting to be aware of, because that means that in the end, in the final analysis, if you like, you have to come back to that kind of defilement to deal with everything, the whole range of problems. Okay, this is very, very nice. All right. So then we have just looked at how you incline your mind, and how you frequently think about something that becomes the inclination of the mind. Yeah, how then you kind of build up a different inclination, and then after a while it becomes natural to have to be kind and having a sense of compassion, etc. You build those things up, and then we have a nice simile here coming up afterwards. And the simile is as follows. Suppose it is the last month of the rainy season, when the crops grow closely together, and a cowherd must take care of the cattle. He would tap and poke them with a staff on this side and to keep them in check. Why is that? For he sees that if they wander into the crops, he will be executed, imprisoned, fined, and condemned. Right? So this is kind of what happens if you think too many bad thoughts. You get executed, fined, and condemned. It's kind of so it's bad, a bad idea to have these bad thoughts. So it kind of makes the point that sometimes we underestimate the power of these things. Yeah, we think that they are not very dangerous, and so it's okay to get a bit upset and angry or whatever. But actually, from this point of view, it is actually very significant. Executed, it kind of makes a very powerful statement about how destructive these kind of thoughts actually are, especially in the long run, especially over lifetimes. You know, these are the things that bind us to samsaric existence. These are the things that ensure that we get reborn again in the future, and sometimes in places that may not be so pleasant. Yeah, and so this is, it is really is problematic. And for that reason, you start to take these things seriously. And this is kind of, the idea of establishing right view about things. The idea that it doesn't really matter so much, you know, you get upset every now and again, you get a bit irritated, it's not a big deal. Well, this is kind of the worldly view. But the Buddha's view is that these things actually matter enormously. And so again, this idea of aligning our way of thinking about things with the way the Buddha thought about things. This is like being executed, having a bad thought. And then, of course, once you have that right view, then that becomes a power in your mind. It kind of lodges with your mindfulness. It's interesting, this idea of mindfulness. What does it actually mean to be mindful? And mindful has this double meaning in the Pali language. On the one hand, it means to be aware, to know what is going on. You're mindful of the breath, you're aware that the breath is happening or whatever. But mindfulness also has this idea of memory. And this is how it is very often explained in the suttas. And in terms of this particular case, the memory is the reminder that things are dangerous, right? So you are aware of what is happening in your mind, and also you're aware, you have that right view, which is always carried with you to some extent, that reminds you that these things are dangerous. So the more powerful our view is, our right view, the more that is kind of lodged with our mindfulness, the more ability you will have to deal with these things when they arise. Not only more ability, the more motivated you will be to actually do something about these things. So right view is always in the background, and always a very important aspect of all of these things. It's kind of interesting here. You have the cowherd, and he must take care of the cattle. He would tap and poke them with his staff. It's like we're tapping and poking our mind. Our mind is a bit like a cow. And of course, the idea of a cow is that a cow is not the creature with great amount of free will, right? A cow is like, okay, you are being, the cowherd kind of decides what you do as a cow, and you kind of get conditioned this way and that way. And so the idea of our mind being a bit like a cow is kind of instructive. Our mind is conditioned by learning to tapping it and instructing it in the right way, giving it a bit of right view, by nudging it this way and that way. The mind becomes like a cow. It just follows along and does the right thing. It's a conditioned thing. It's not so much autonomous thing that does what it wants in the world, independent of phenomena. No, it doesn't work like that. It's a conditioned thing. And that's good in a sense, because it means that we can't change. If the mind was solid, this is one of the problems with the delusion of a self. We feel like the mind is far more solid than it actually is. And that solidity, that sense of solidity, can stop us from practicing, because we don't understand the potential for the mind to change. We don't understand the potential for overcoming defilements, don't understand the potential for joy and happiness and all these kind of things. And so sometimes the sense of self can stand in the way of mental cultivation, because it's not obvious that this cultivation is even possible. So mind is more like a cow, it's more like a robot, ding, program it in the right way, and it kind of follows along. Ding, ding, ding. So you tap this mind in the right way, and then to keep them in check so the mind doesn't stray into all of these negative things, so you don't have to face those bad consequences. In the same way, I saw that unskillful qualities have the drawbacks of sordidness and corruption, and that skillful qualities have the benefit and cleansing power of renunciation. So these unskillful qualities, the akusala dhamma, they are sordid. Yeah, they are kind of, they drag you down. You feel like a lesser person if you are in the grip of these qualities of mind. Yeah, you know, I don't know about you, but when you feel that the defilements are there, it feels more coarse. Yeah, you feel more coarse as a person. You don't feel refined when that happens. And you feel like low. You feel more like an animal, right? Because this is what the animal realm is like. The animal realm is more driven by these kind of defilements. And this is kind of the whole point. This is why you get reborn in a lower realm. That's precisely because you have more of these defilements in the mind. And so we often look at people and we, you know, it's kind of, some people are basically more like animals, yeah? Because they have more of these defilements. That's the way it is. And each one of us, we kind of fluctuate. Sometimes we're more like animals, sometimes less, depending on what's going on. And so if you look at your mind and you see what it's like, and when your mind feels kind of fairly cleansed or pure and bright, yeah, it actually feels good. Sometimes we look down upon the idea of purity, but purity is actually good because it feels good. It has a very positive, your personal experience of being pure is actually a very positive feeling. Yeah. So getting rid of some of these defilements is a very, very good thing. Yeah. So being sordid, being low, dragged down in the mud is not something that we want to do. And you feel it has is corrupt. Corruption here is corrupted. The mind is defiled, yeah, and it's kind of dirty, basically. Yeah. And so then you feel the benefit and the cleansing power of renunciation. You renounce certain things, and it cleans things up, and you feel the positive consequences. So we have looked at the negative side. Now we're going to have a brief look at the positive side. And he's the Buddha-to-be, he says here that as I meditated, heedful, keen and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose, or a thought of goodwill, or a thought of compassion. Yeah, these are the three good thoughts, the opposite side. And so what is a thought of renunciation? What does that even mean? And a thought of renunciation is a bit like you want to meditate and be peaceful rather than indulge in the world. That's a thought of renunciation, right? Because you are giving up some of your comforts and you are just kind of meditating instead. Sometimes you may go on a meditation retreat, maybe you undertake the eight precepts. The eight precepts are a bit more renunciant than the five precepts. Yeah, you don't eat in the afternoon, you don't kind of... Maybe that's the only difference between this retreat and an eight-precept retreat. Yeah, and then you kind of renounce a little bit more. And I would recommend you sometimes to try that. It's a positive thing to take on the eight precepts occasionally. There's a fascinating thing in the suttas where the Buddha is visiting his family, his clan. Yeah, and his clan are the Sakyan clan. And he asks them, do you keep the eight precepts on the Uposatha day? The Uposatha day is the full moon day and the new moon day. And they say, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. And he kind of tells them off for that, you know, in a gentle way, right? He says, oh, it's not a good, you know, please keep the eight precepts. So, and this kind of, because the idea here is that it helps you to lean in a direction where you value the spiritual side of life more than the material side of life. You get challenged a little bit. Yeah, okay, I can't eat in the afternoon. What does that feel like? And it may be difficult for you, right? Because you are used to having a dinner in the evening. Well, here you have dinner, but and then not having dinner in the evening is actually very hard. Yeah, because you have to give up this thing that you're so used to. For me, it's really easy not to have dinner in the evening. I have done this for 30 years. But for all of you, it's hard. And so it challenges you a little bit. You have to look at things in a different way. And one of the big things, big mistakes that people do when they on April, they think, okay, this is scary. I've got to eat a lot for lunch, right? I have this enormous meal at lunch. And then they try to meditate in the afternoon. They go, oh, no, this is... So that's the danger there. You kind of go overboard because you are scared about these kind of things. So you learn how to deal with this. And you don't make the sensory things of the world so important. And you kind of lean the mind in different direction. So renunciation is not something kind of massive. It is also just, even just undertaking the five precepts, having a commitment to being kind is actually a kind of renunciation. There are many things you can't do if you want to be kind, right? You can't do the things that are not kind. So that's a kind of renunciation right there. And down the track, of course, renunciation, monastic life is a kind of renunciation. Getting into deep samadhi is a kind of renunciation. And every step you renounce something, renouncing sounds like a negative thing. It sounds like you're giving something up. But of course, the whole point of renunciation is to achieve something which actually is higher. Yeah? So you achieve something more. You're not really giving anything up at all. Instead, you are moving towards a higher plane or higher level with more joy, more peace, more positive things. So it's important to understand this word in the right way. People think of renunciation and may think of some kind of person who's torturing themselves. That is not the point at all. It's not about torturing. It's about giving up the lower to achieve the higher. So all of these things are aspects of renouncing. So you have a thought of renouncing means that you kind of understanding what this is about, what the purpose of this is. And then the Buddha-to-be, or the Buddha says, I understood this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. It does not lead to hurting myself, to hurting others, or hurting both. It nourishes wisdom. It's on the side of freedom from anguish, and it leads to extinguishment. Yeah, it has all of these positive effects. When you renounce, you're never in conflict with other people. It is when we are competing in the world of the five senses. This is one of the problems of the sensory world because it's a common realm to all of us, the five senses. We compete and we are in conflict because of that in that world. But when you renounce, when you go inwards, that conflict ceases. And you actually start, these things then lead to your own happiness, etc., for these kind of reasons. And you also, of course, moving you to a higher kind of joy. So there's no hurting there. It nourishes wisdom, because you are giving up the defilements that cloud the mind, that give you a vested interest in that reality, that makes it impossible for you to see things in a neutral way. So it nourishes wisdom. It's on the side of freedom from anguish. These things are, things in the mind that makes the mind lesser. And it leads to extinguishment. You're extinguishing these defilements. And as you're extinguishing them, then the whole mind is heading in that direction towards Nirvana. So, and of course that is also true with the thoughts of goodwill. Goodwill here is really the opposite of ill will. So we could say metta, loving kindness, goodwill, friendliness, all of these words are just basically meaning the same thing. And then harmlessness, which is compassion. So that all of these have the same kind of positive effect. And then he says, if I were to keep on thinking about this and considering this, considering renouncing goodwill and compassion all night, all day, all night and day, I see no danger that would come from that. Still, thinking and considering for too long would tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind is stressed. And when the mind is stressed, it is far from samadhi, from stillness, from immersion. So I stilled, settled, unified, and stilled, samadhied the mind internally. Why is that? So that my mind would not be stressed. So this is interesting. Even there are this kind of thinking, there is no danger in that kind of thinking because it doesn't lead you astray. You're not creating any bad karma. You are moving away from rebirth and all of these kind of things. And yet, there is a problem. That is that the very fact that there is a movement of the mind, that the mind is, the very idea of thinking tires the mind, right? And we kind of know that. The more you think, the more the mind is running around, the more exhausted you feel in the evening when you finally go to bed or whatever, because your mind has been very active. And with the thinking goes willpower, and with the willpower goes even more tiredness, etc., etc. So you can see what is happening here. It's like there's a gradualness to the path. And this is a really important point to keep in mind. So the gradualness is that, first of all, you start with the bad mental content. You purify your mind from the negative thinking. Then, when there still is a mental content, only then do you kind of deal with the other mental content. And then you go towards peace and towards meditation practice. And this idea that things need to be done according to a certain sequence is very significant. Sometimes you see people, they go on a meditation retreat and they sit down and they want to still their mind immediately without any kind of idea of preparing yourself by living well or by thinking the right way or anything like that, just straight into meditation. It's going to be really difficult. Yeah, in fact, it's going to be impossible. You can't be done. You can't. Your mind is going to run riot and it's going to be very unhappy. It's not going to be able to still a mind which is full of defilements, basically. Yeah. So getting the sequence right here is very important. And this is why, before going on meditation retreats and things, learn to keep the precepts, learn to live a life with greater moral integrity and all of these kind of things. And as you do that, you're preparing yourself for meditation practice. Get the sequence right. Know what your problems are. If you have problems with them, kind of really coarse things, right? Then deal with that first of all. If you are a compulsive liar, okay? I don't think anyone here is a compulsive liar, but let's just say someone is a compulsive liar. You've got to deal with that first. That's a big problem for you. Or even if you lie occasionally, deal with the five precepts first of all. Then look into your mind. Do you have some very serious defilements? Are you kind of an angry character, gets angry very easily? Okay, deal with that first of all. If you have a lot of anger, meditation is going to be very hard because the mind is very restless, agitated, going to the wrong place all the time. So you have to know what the problem is. Deal with that. Then, when the mind is fairly pure, that is when you're ready to practice meditation. Don't practice with meditation when the mind is really impure and really in a bad state. What to do then if the mind is very impure? If the mind is very impure, have a cup of tea. That's what I recommend. Thank you for the cup of tea. Have a cup of tea. Go for a walk. Yeah, around here. If you feel that you are really restless, you can't deal with this anymore, don't want to hear any more of these blooming suttas, the Buddha's kind of asking too much of me, don't want to hear anything more from that. The Buddha might be nice, but not now. I don't want to have anything more to do with the Buddha now. Later on, maybe. Whatever it is, yeah, you are upset about something because this is just the nature of life, or you find some very strong craving or desires coming up, do something else. Go for a walk, go back to your room, lie down for a short while, do whatever it takes, and then come back later on. When the mind is very defiled, it's not much point in even trying to sit down. It's just too difficult. So remember this, yeah, sequential development of the path is so important. And that's why we have looked previously at the idea of sense restraint, and this is really an expansion of the idea of sense restraint, because that is really a prior thing that we do before meditation practice happens. You learn to deal with the mind in the right way, purify the coarser aspects of the mind. Then mindfulness has a chance to arise. Then when mindfulness has a chance to arise, then meditation becomes possible. Yeah? It's kind of one of those things that I think is very underestimated and under-communicated in the Buddhist world. Very often people kind of almost, they come off straight off the street and they get put down on a cushion and say, meditate, watch your breath. It's crazy. It is kind of really contrary to the idea of the gradual training. It's a nice idea. It's not crazy, but it's a nice thought, of course. People are trying to do the right thing, but they haven't really understood the message of the Buddha. It's a gradual training. It's a gradual path. Meditation is the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, not the first factor, factor number seven. There's a lot to be done prior to meditation. Anyway, so this is what is coming out here, right? This is a sequence of things. So you give up the bad thoughts. Only when you have given up the bad thoughts do you give up all thinking. There's a sequence. You don't give up all thinking at once, because that's impossible. You can only give up all thinking after you have given up the bad thinking. So then you give up the good thinking, because you realize even the good thinking tires you out in the long run. Because of the tiring of the mind, of the body, then you decide, okay, I'm going to practice samadhi, stillness of the mind. I'm going to do some meditation practice, watch the breath or whatever, and then achieve this thing here called the mind. I stilled, settled, unified, and immersed my mind internally so that it will not be stressed. And this sequence of words here in the Pali, still, settled, unified, and immersed. This is a sequence of words that basically refer to the jhana states. So the Buddha to be, is he talking about the jhanas, really? Yeah, where you are fully let go of thinking. And this is kind of one of the suttas that really says that thinking is let go of in the jhana states. Thinking is gone, the world is gone, and you really settle down and you energize yourself. And of course, when you come out of these states, and even if you just have a little bit of stillness in your mind, you feel energized. Have you noticed that, how meditation energizes you when it works? When it doesn't work, you fall asleep. Okay, it doesn't energize you, but when it works, it energizes you. And this is one of the great benefits of meditation practice. And this is what this is about right here. Okay, so that's kind of a nice cue to do a bit of meditation. So let's do a few minutes of meditation together. Okay. So, anyone have any comments or questions they would like to ask? Yes, please. Yes. It is a good idea. It is just how you do it. And sometimes, if you feel a bit upset about something, you know, that's when you use loving kindness as a countermeasure to being upset about something. It's important you do it in the right way, because if you do it in a superficial way, it's like you're suppressing the anger. You're not really overcoming it, but suppressing it, pushing it down. It doesn't really overcome it. So you have to do this in a way that actually you use it. I will come back to this later on, because it's going to be a big part of what we talk about later on, dealing with resentment and ill will. But the basic idea is that you have to shift your focus. If you have ill will, probably a person coming to mind, so you shift your attention to a good quality in that person, right? That's what you do. And then actually you eliminate the whole ill will. You don't see that anymore. The ill will just disappears. Or if that is too hard, you have compassion for that person. So you see, you're changing your attitude rather than just kind of, you know, pushing metta on the top of the ill will, which is not really a very skillful way of doing it. Yes, please.
So should thoughts of ill will, like towards ourselves, be dealt with in a similar way?
Or? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Please don't have ill will with yourself. It's just a matter of appreciating ourselves and most people, you know, everyone here has a very good reason for having good, high degree of self-worth and self-esteem, because people here are good people. And sometimes we forget this. And sometimes we focus on the wrong things, because our society encourages us to focus on things that are superficial and silly and kind of irrelevant. And the really good qualities are often forgotten about. So, feel good about yourself. I order you to feel good about yourself. So, yes, please. Yeah.
And also, before the pandemic, I taught meditation in jail, to young men in jail.
Yeah.
I would be very loath to start with sila.
Yeah.
Them to taste.
Yeah.
And then, you know, maybe weave it in, but not talk about the...
Right. Yeah. No, yeah, fair enough. I think that's, you have a good point there. You know, it sounds like you become a moralizer or something if you go in and talk to them about sila, you know, and that you have to be very careful how you do things. That's a very good point. And I think in some situations, you're right, it may be okay to just focus on the mindfulness without focusing on other factors, like you're saying. So use your wisdom. Yeah, and you obviously are, so you're already kind of doing the right thing, I think. So I think the mindfulness movement is a good movement. Yeah, it is doing good things. It is certainly not a bad movement, except maybe when it is used for bad purposes. That can occasionally happen in society. It is good, but it is also very limited, and I think that is the downside. It only goes so far, and then it kind of comes to very clear blocks in the road. It doesn't go any further. And so as a starting point, it's great. And if that leads to people, you know, becoming curious about what this is all about, where it comes from, and how to develop it further, and it has done a great service. And even if it does a little bit of service, it's fine. But even with your people in jail, you know, I would say that there are ways of even, kind of explaining to them the idea of morality, because, you know, maybe not straight away, but kind of over time to bring it in. Because many people in jail are not bad people, right? They make a mistake in life, they end up in jail. So you can even encourage them to remember, actually, you probably have lots of good qualities. Why do they come to your meditation class if they haven't got good qualities, right? So encourage them to see that in themselves. Because our society is often very harsh on people. Yeah, we divide society. We think that people in jail are bad. The rest of us are good. It's not that simple as that, right? It's very grey. We kind of cover this whole scale. And sometimes the people in jail may be better than those who are out of jail, for goodness sake. Yeah. So you need to encourage people to see their good qualities and their good sides and say, you made a mistake. Forgive yourself. Let go. And when you forgive yourself and let go, that is when you have the possibility of making a better life for yourself in the future. If you hold on to those bad qualities inside of you and you feel judged by society, actually that is when we often repeat these things. But if we're able to let go, able to see our good sides, able to feel encouraged that we have good, we have the possibility of improving ourselves, actually then we do that. It's fascinating. I have noticed how Ajahn Brahm is one of those persons who always sees the good qualities in you. And he never criticizes me, even though there's lots of things that probably are worthy of criticism. And you feel like you want to live up to that, you know, to that high expectation, the high kind of perception that he has of you. You want to live up to that, because you don't want to kind of disappoint people or whatever. But if everyone thinks you are a bad person anyway, probably often you don't care less with other people, with other people. Thing. So I think that just you go with the flow. You probably know what is right. Yes, it sounds like you have a lot of experience already. Do you want to come back on that one? Are you you're right. Okay, good. I just want to give people a chance to kind of respond if they need. So okay, good. Yes.
Do you think there's any value or benefit to befriending or contemplating or staying with the defilements a little bit longer so that we can uncover and realize the underlying woundedness and vulnerability and fear that's there, rather than just substituting positive emotions or really get in touch with that shadow side or to the deeper fear and vulnerability?
You can do that. It can be harder because when you are in the grip of these defilements, very often it's very hard to see them clearly what is going on. But you can see it, especially when they arise. Yeah, you can see that they arise. You can see the causality. So if you kind of catch them quickly and you see what's going on, you can often see something going on there. So just a general awareness of the defilements, can be helpful. But just staying with the defilements, staying with it, I think over time is not necessarily all that useful. I mean, you have to know for yourself, basically. See what works for you. But the general idea of understanding the causality behind the defilements actually is very, very important. And once you understand the causality, you can do something with the cause, then the defilement itself is undermined. Things like ill will and anger, usually it comes from seeing the negative aspects or qualities in another person, right? If you see something negative, something that you resist, something you don't like, very often ill will arises. And it becomes obvious fairly quickly in many cases. If it is fear and anxiety, it can be a bit more tricky. Yeah, fear and anxiety can be something that you... Sometimes it's kind of amorphous. You don't know why you're anxious. You're just kind of anxious about something. Yeah. And then can be useful to investigate. Maybe you can find the cause, and then you can deal with the cause of these things. But generally, fear and anxiety is about, the kind of, I think, universal way of dealing with that is the idea that if you're living this kind of life, then good things happen to good people. So your future basically is really positive. It's bright if you are a good person. And by kind of repeatedly remembering that, some of that anxiety, some of it is kind of just not really all that rational because it comes from habits in the past. And habits in the past are just habits without really having any good foundation or whatever. So find the right way, and know, look at it a little bit, and then after looking, okay, enough looking, okay, time to overcome, or whatever. But sometimes it's also useful to overcome quickly, because once the defilement is established in the mind, very often very hard to get rid of. So there's many, many facts to consider. Quick one.
I was just going to say that I really appreciate the BSWA's, the monks that talk about when the hindrances arise, being kind.
Yeah.
Hindrances like Bodhidharma and some of the other ones that have really expressed that, they really helped me to out of it.
Right. Okay. Good. Okay. Great. That's another. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Thank you for that one. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just gonna ask about clarifying defilements because we have the hindrances, the five hindrances, and we have the ten fetters, and how do you define defilements and like the poly?
Yeah. Defilement is like an umbrella term for all the bad stuff. That's kind of defilement. Yeah. So if it's bad, it's a defilement. Yeah. Yeah. So usually we talk about three root defilements: ill will, desire, and delusion. These are kind of the three root defilements, and all kind of things that arise from that, like jealousies or harmfulness, or sometimes they have this long list of kind of things in the suttas, like a kind of domineering attitudes and whatever it is. That is kind of, that you are driven by something which is unwholesome inside of you. That's a defilement. Yeah. Okay, let's carry on. So, you still the mind because you know that actually you want to re-energize the mind, get rid of some of the tiredness, and of course that energized mind is then that very useful one, because that is where you can then go even further on the path, have insights and all this kind of stuff. So you need that energy. The power of the mind is very important. So we have the same thing for all of these three kinds of good thoughts: renunciation, goodwill, and compassion. And in all of these cases, you overcome the bad thoughts. First of all, you are kind to the bad thoughts. You don't work not too hard on yourself or whatever. And then you move on to the good thoughts. And actually, just being kind to the good thoughts is really a way of overcoming the bad thought as well, isn't it? Because that kindness kind of counteracts the bad ones. It's a nice way of thinking about it. And then you, again, unify the mind. Then we have the idea again of what you frequently think and consider. Whatever a mendicant or non-mendicant or anyone frequently thinks about and considers becomes their heart's inclination. If they often think about and consider thoughts of renunciation or of goodwill or of compassion, they have given up the thoughts of the sensory realm, the thoughts of ill will, the thoughts of harmfulness, to cultivate the thought of renunciation. They incline to thoughts of renunciation. And if they often think about goodwill, etc., the same thing again. How do you know if your mind inclines towards renunciation? And one way of knowing that is to see what happens in your meditation practice. Where does your mind lean in your meditation? Especially when you go on a retreat, when you have a bit of time to get away from the kind of problems of daily life, the problems of difficult bosses or whatever it might be, whatever it happens in daily life. And you withdraw a little bit from that, and then you kind of come to the baseline of the mind, what your mind state, kind of your general mind state really is about. In daily life, it can be hard to know because there's so much things going on, what your kind of base level or default level, if you like, really is. But when you get rid of most of those distractions of the world, you kind of come to the more normal state of your mind. So where does your mind incline at that point? And people will have very different experiences. Some people will find that they're just constantly fantasizing about things and thinking about things in the world and thinking about their work and family, and they can't really stop those thoughts. And that is because your mind is still very much inclining towards the sensory realm. But other people will find that their mind actually quite happily goes towards meditation. It quite happily empties out the thoughts. The mind kind of leaning in that direction. And that is what it means, that your mind has now, taken on. It frequently thinks and ponders on renunciation because it is leaning in that direction already. So either you have developed that in this life, or maybe comes from past lives or whatever, but you are now leaning in that direction. So you can, this is how you know what your state of mind, your kind of default state of mind is like. It's like your existence almost, your state of existence, the things that you have picked up, what you are attaching to almost, what is important in your life. This is how you know that. And then that also gives you an idea of what kind of rebirth you will have, because that interest of the mind, the inclination of the mind, is where the mind will tend to go also when you get reborn, right? So it gives you some idea. So if you are already leaning towards peace and quiet in your meditation, that's a very good sign. It means that that is where the mind will go in the future, whatever happens to you. So this gives you an idea of your kind of inclination, whatever you want to call it. So that is the heart's inclination already. And if you are a very profound meditator, your mind will just incline towards bliss, and then it will incline towards the jhanas and all these kind of things, and it just, bang, they happen like that. So then we come to the simile again. Suppose it's the last month of summer, when all the crops have been gathered within a village, and a cowherd must take care of the cattle. While at the foot of a tree, or in the open, he needs only be mindful that the cattle are there. In the same way, I needed only to be mindful that those things were present. Yeah. So when there is no crops around, the crops here is, of course, the sensual pleasures probably, right? So there's no crops around because you kind of abandon the thought of those crops. So you can't really think about those things anymore. So the cattle are not going to do bad things and eat up all the food for the village. And so you just can just chill at the root of a tree and relax and kind of sit back and put your hands behind your head and kind of look up into the sky occasionally and just be reasonably mindful that the cattle are in the right place. And this is what happens when meditation is going well. Yeah, you just relax, you sit back, and all you do is you're mindful that the breath is there, not doing anything apart from that. Just relaxing, because your mind is already leaning in the right direction. This is where, ideally, we would like to be. So, the sutta says, it says, my energy was roused up and unflagging. My mindfulness was established and lucid. My body was tranquil and undisturbed. And my mind was immersed in samadhi. So this is what happens when this really comes together, when all your thoughts and all your everything kind of is heading in the right direction, you become energized. This is kind of one of those beautiful results of the practice. It's one of the seven factors of awakening, is a factor of energy. And so energy of the mind, and energy is one of the important things to understand about the idea of energy. It is quite different from the idea of effort. Effort and energy are not the same thing in the Pali Suttas. Effort is what you do on the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, you put forth a little bit of effort. You try to be wise. You try to reflect in the right way. You try to consider things carefully. Yeah, this is kind of effort. Yeah, you're trying. Okay, how can I be? How can I do the right thing, etc. You're putting forth effort, but energy is actually the naturally occurring energy in the mind. Yeah, it is like the mind becomes powerful and bright. You feel the energy within. And this is what we're talking about here, the energy of the mind. And then it becomes very easy because you don't really have to force yourself to do the right thing anymore. It just happens almost automatically. You are energized. And with the energy comes mindfulness, because being energetic is a very pleasant state of mind. Yeah, the energetic mind is often also joyful. Yeah, if you feel joyful, right? What is your mind like when you feel joy? You feel also energy usually. They come together, and the more happiness and joy you feel in your life, the more energy you will have. So these things building up together. So mindfulness, joy, and energy, these are kind of qualities that revolve around each other. They tend to be present at the same time. So when you have energy, you are mindful because it's pleasant to be here. When you have energy and mindfulness, you have joy, all coming together. So the mindfulness is established and lucid. Yeah, unflagging is another translation that is sometimes used. Yeah, this is actually not unremitting, I think, is the translation used. It is steady. It doesn't decline. It's powerful, right? Powerful energy that doesn't decline, mindfulness that is always present in a sense. This is what you get at this particular point. The body is tranquil and undisturbed. Yeah, the body feels really settled. No restlessness, no agitation. Yeah, sometimes you just want to sit here forever. Have you had that feeling sometimes? Yeah, and you go up to the retreat managers, I don't want to go, I don't want to leave, I want to stay here. Can I please stay a bit longer here? And they say, or maybe, as you So, yeah, and this is a very beautiful point. If you ever get to that point in your meditation where the body really settles down, and you kind of just, you are mindful, you are aware, the energy is strong, you don't want to do anything else in the whole world, yeah, you feel like it's rock solid, nothing you want to do, beautiful state of mind, a beautiful state of the body. Yeah. I remember a long, long time ago when I was a young monk, I was sitting next to Ajahn Brahm. He was teaching a retreat and I was just kind of coming along as I was an anagarika or something. This is a long time ago now. And I was sitting next to him and the kind of lay people sitting in front. And it's kind of amazing to sit next to meditator like Ajahn Brahm because there's like this force field around him, right? And one of the things I noticed when he was sitting there, because there were some mosquitoes coming into the room, yeah, and those mosquitoes, they were kind of going around and around Ajahn Brahm. They never settled down, yeah. Most people, they settled down eventually, but Ajahn Brahm was like round and round and round. And it's like the mosquito was confused. What is this thing? Is it a human being? Is it a rock? What is going on here, right? And this is kind of this idea of becoming so peaceful that it's actually you cannot really distinguish between a human being and a stump or something like that. Yeah, you're kind of so solid. And of course, also the tranquility of the body that you get at this point means that you give off very little carbon dioxide and these kind of things. Yeah, so basically you are actually environmentally friendly. You don't give off any carbon dioxide. We should meditate more. It just came to me. Yeah, this is the... less greenhouse gases, okay, more meditation, folks, we're going to... So basically, you come to this point where you are really... you almost don't exist as a human being, and the mosquito doesn't know what to do. Circling. Mosquito is thinking, what's going on here? So, anyway, that kind of reminded me of when you become very, very peaceful, you become this kind of environmentally friendly rock just sitting there. So, so your body becomes really tranquil and undisturbed, and the mind becomes stilled in samadhi. So your mind becomes focused, the mind comes together. Why does the mind come together? Because the mind is very happy. When you are happy, it's easy to be stilled, it's easy to stay with what you're doing, because what you're doing is just so pleasant. Why would you want to do anything else? One of the main reasons we are distracted in meditation, the reason why we think about, you know, all kind of things, even the most crazy things. Have you ever thought about crazy things in your meditation? Okay, welcome to the club. Yeah, this is kind of, everyone thinks about crazy things. And sometimes you wonder, why am I thinking about this? This doesn't make any sense at all. And often the reason is very simple, because you're not enjoying it enough. Yeah, the mind wants to do something more enjoyable, and crazy thinking is more enjoyable than just doing nothing boring or whatever. So the more you enjoy the meditation, the more peaceful and still your mind is going to be, because the other stuff doesn't make any sense anymore. Now you're having a good time. That's how samadhi can arise. Naturally, without any force, any willpower, the mind just goes there because it enjoys what it's doing. So we have the translation here, immersed in samadhi. Immersion is the translation used by Bhante Sujato for samadhi, and is that a good translation? Maybe. And what is interesting about translation is that sometimes you hear different translations that give different angles on a particular word. Yeah. So, one very common translation for samadhi is concentration, and we have been banned at Bodhinyana Monastery from saying concentration. Because concentration, usually, the way we use that word, it means using willpower. Yeah, you're focusing hard, concentrating on what you're doing. And that is not what we're trying to do in the meditation practice. We're trying to make it natural, happen by itself, making it enjoyable. So concentration is, even though it is not wrong, because when samadhi comes together, you are focused in that sense. It gives the wrong idea of what we are supposed to do. So I... personally like Ajahn Brahm's translation, which is stillness for samadhi. I think stillness is a very beautiful word, and I kind of try to use that. But immersion is also, it's nice, it's maybe a little bit technical, but the idea is that you are immersed in the experience. Yeah, you're fully, like you immerse something in water. Water is on all sides. It's kind of enveloped in water in the same way. You are immersed in your experience. You are enveloped in that experience. And that is kind of the idea behind this this kind of translation. So, yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes when you look into the etymology of these words, the background of these words, where they come from, how they were used in ancient India, you can come up with all kinds of interesting translations. I remember one of Ajahn Sujato's translations for jhana was illumination. And illumination is quite nice, yeah? Your mind is illuminated, it's bright, powerful. That's kind of, I don't know, I like that translation. These days, the common translation for jhana is absorption is used quite a lot these days. And again, it's this idea, similar to immersion, you are absorbed in a state, you're fully within a particular quality and state. Anyway, that is the Dveda Vitakka Sutta for you, two kinds of thoughts. And you're kind of hopefully now kind of getting the idea a little bit of how to deal with negative thinking, especially with ill will and these kind of things. As you can see, it is a lot about using wisdom, not using willpower, but using wisdom as much as you can. So now what I want to do, I want to move on to the next sutta. And this sutta is going to be a continuation on how to deal with thinking. This next sutta is called the Vitakka Santana Sutta in Pali, and it quite literally means the calming of thought. Vitakka is thought, Santana is the calming. Yeah, so this is how to calm thoughts. And this is another very interesting sutta, and it gives five ways of overcoming the thinking mind. Yeah, so it's an expansion really on the previous one. In the previous one we saw one specific way using wisdom power. This gives kind of five ways. So we're going to look at this and it will kind of broaden out the idea a little bit. It will also come back to the question you had before about using metta to overcome the ill will there. Can we wait till the break afterwards? Would that be all right with a question?
I just have a quick question.
Yeah. All right, okay.
So if you would say, the same way I needed to only be mindful of those things, what is those things referred to?
Those things, the good qualities of mind.
Okay.
Yeah, so you are just remembering the good qualities of mind. Yeah, you're aware that they are there, not the bad ones, yeah. All right, so let's just delve into this next sutta. This is the Middle Length Sayings number 20, and this is how it goes. So, I have heard. At one time the Buddha was staying near Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There the Buddha addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, venerable sir, they replied, and the Buddha said this. Mendicants, a mendicant, or really anyone, non-mendicant or non-mendicant, a mendicant committed to the higher mind should focus on five foundations of meditation from time to time. What five? So here, committed to the higher mind, this is the adi citta. What does that mean? It means that we are trying to move towards samadhi. Yeah, samadhi is the higher mind, especially the jhanas are the higher mind in the suttas. It's kind of a nice way of thinking about the mind, the higher mind, the elevated mind, the lofty mind, this idea of something special that we're trying to achieve, not the ordinary mind, not the kind of usual stuff, but this is like the higher stuff we're trying to achieve. And this is kind of very true to experience. These things feel higher. They feel like they're elevated out of the ordinary world. This is kind of the purpose of these things. And it's important to remember these things. There's another nice sutta called the Earth Remover Sutta, which talks about the refining of gold. And it compares the refining of the cultivation of the mind, or the refining of the mind, with the refining of gold. The mind is like gold. The mind is extremely precious. But just like gold only shines, gold is only beautiful when all the defilements of the gold are removed. Yeah, when gold kind of comes out of the ground, it kind of doesn't look very nice. Apparently, I've never really seen gold in that state, but that's what they say. Yeah, but when you kind of purify the gold, get rid of all the impurities, and you put it into the furnace to burn out the impurities of the gold, then it becomes incredibly shiny and beautiful at a certain point. Yeah, in the same way, the mind is like gold. Yeah, we are trying to mine gold here. It's a kind of nice idea, isn't it? Gold is like the most valuable precious substance in the world, and this is across all cultures in the world. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. The mind is the most precious substance of all. Of course, it goes way, way beyond gold. But the simile here is evocative of something very beautiful and powerful and very, very useful. So we need to refine it. And only when you refine the mind, get rid of the defilements, do the qualities of the gold of the mind really start to emerge. The brightness of the mind, the beauty of the mind comes out of that. So this is what we're seeing. This is why this is called the higher mind. Yeah, it comes into its own when the defilements are removed in this way. These are all very evocative similes to give us an inclination of what it is that we're trying to achieve, what we're trying to move towards. So the higher mind, so to get to these things, we should focus on five foundations. These are called nimittas in Pali, nimittas. Yeah, it's kind of, this word nimitta is used in many different ways. Sometimes we talk about samadhi nimitta, and here it actually is used as a, again, as a sign, but he calls it foundations, yeah, five signs or five ways, or here is a bit unclear exactly how it is used. So five foundations of meditation from time to time, and time to time here means whenever there is a problem that arises. Yeah, when the problem arises, that's when we use these things. So here we are talking about meditation practice, and we're talking about what to do inside meditation practice. These qualities, this way of dealing with the mind, can also be used outside of meditation, but because we are looking at the cultivation of the higher mind, this is mostly about meditation practice. So how do we deal with things when they arise in the mind as we are trying to watch the breath or whatever? So five things, right? So this is kind of promising, five different ways. So if one doesn't work, you go to the next one, etc., etc. So take a mendicant or anyone who is focusing on some foundation of meditation that gives rise to bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion. That mendicant should focus on some other foundation of meditation connecting with the skillful. As they do so, those bad thoughts are given up and come to an end. The mind becomes stilled internally. It settles, unifies, and becomes immersed in samadhi. So, it's a little bit, the translation here is a little bit, how shall we put it, interesting here. I don't want to criticize my good friends, so I have to... It's not entirely clear exactly what he is getting at here with this. So here, what the Pali is saying is that when you pay attention to a certain thing, when you pay attention to whatever, to a certain sign, unwholesome qualities arise. So when a mendicant focuses on some foundation of meditation, basically what the Pali is saying is that when you focus on something, whatever that thing might be, and that gives rise to bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion. Yeah, it's just basically using ayoniso manasikara, unskillful attention, to a certain thing, a nimitta. That thing can be anything. Yeah. So, for example, if I look at someone and I kind of some ill will arises because of someone, I don't know, they're not pleasing or whatever. then there's two things you can do in that kind of situation. It says here that you then focus on some other foundation. What does that mean? It means that two things you can do. Either you can then place your attention, take your attention away from that person and look at someone you find pleasing. Yeah, this kind of one way of doing this. And that's okay. But more powerful than doing that is actually to change your perception of that person you're looking at. And that is actually much more important. So if I look at someone, you look at someone here, I don't know if people... It's interesting, when you live together with many people like this, it's very easy for people to sometimes irritate you a little bit, yeah, because we are different backgrounds, we think in different ways. It's almost impossible to live together with a large group of people, never get a little bit irritated. It's almost impossible. So then when that happens, if someone does irritate you a little bit, you shift your focus to the fact that, well, actually, it's amazing that these people are here. What a good fortune I have to be part of a community like this. These are good people. The underlying qualities are wonderful. Why worry about this little thing that they're doing that gives rise to irritation? By just remembering the good qualities of everyone who is here, specifically the person you're looking at, that irritation just evaporates like that. You're changing your focus on that person. And this is what you should be doing also in the case of if you feel a little bit of ill will, you change your focus to actually something that is beautiful in that person. And as you do that, that ill will doesn't stand a chance because you're looking at the broader picture of things. So that is really the idea. So this method is often called the idea of substitution. But I think substitution doesn't quite get at what is going on. But substitution is like you just replace one thing with another. But it's this particular kind of substitution where you know to focus on the good qualities. You don't just force metta or kindness on top of the ill will. That doesn't really work so well. What you do is you shift your focus. And this is what it is saying here in a sense. You are shifting your focus to another aspect of that thing. And through that shift of focus, the mind naturally moves in a wholesome direction. So that's really what is going on here. And then, as you do that, especially within your meditation, you can very quickly see that something comes up, hopefully, because hopefully you are reasonably mindful, unless you are really lost in thought, in which case you may not see that. And then you can make that change fairly quickly as a consequence. So... then it has this, and then it sounds very easy the way it is said here, so you give that up, and then once that is done, your mind becomes still, settled, unified, and you go into samadhi. It may not always be that straightforward, but that is kind of the general sense of progress that we're looking for here. And then it says it's like a deft carpenter or their apprentice who has knocked out would knock out or extract a large peg with a finer peg. In the same way, you should follow this particular procedure. So a large peg is like the bad thought. A fine peg, it's still a peg because it's still a thought. It's not the kind of thing you don't ultimately want to get rid of all pegs. But the large peg, know the sequence of things. Get rid of the large peg with the small peg. And then you get rid of the small peg by bringing the mind to samadhi afterwards. Same thing we saw before in the two kinds of thought sutta. Same idea. Knowing the sequence of things. So to be able to do this kind of thing, to be able to make this kind of thing work, you actually have to build up this idea that people around you are good people. You have to build up that. You have to know that that is true in a deep way. And the more you are aware of that, the more clear that thought is in your mind, the more powerful this kind of reflection will be. If you really do feel that the people who are here are good people, in a deep sense, then it will be easy to make this kind of shift. If it is a superficial feeling that, you know it, but it's kind of superficial, it will not be as powerful. So as with so many things on the Buddhist path, you need to develop these ideas. You need to make them powerful and strong, and then they will be incredibly effective on the path like this. So a lot of the Buddhist teaching is not just about meditation practice or being kind, but again, it's this idea of developing certain outlooks, outlooks that have to do with right view, looking at people in the right way, looking at the world in the right way. And all of these things is what ultimately then allows you to do this kind of practice and live in this particular way. All right, so let's do a little bit more of meditation again. Okay, any comments or questions from anyone? Yes, please.
The idea of substitution makes me think of mudita.
Say again?
Mudita?
Yeah, right, yeah, absolutely. So you see the good qualities and then you kind of appreciate that. That would be like mudita, yeah? Yeah, so these, some of these, they're very closely related to each other. Yeah, metta, mudita, sometimes it's kind of hard to make a very clear distinction, but you can certainly call it that, where you can. So, yes, appreciative joy, yeah. Indeed. Yes.
When I've applied this, works incredibly fast.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me. I was also wondering about when I find myself criticizing someone, there's a sensation of pain.
Yeah.
You know, immediately. And then, why is that pain there? And then I think, well, gosh, you know, I could hardly change the smallest thing about myself.
Right.
Yeah. It's like you're criticizing yourself.
Right, yeah.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
That lifts it right away.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. I think that's a very useful contemplation. Actually, I do that myself. I think, you know, how hard it is to change ourselves. How can we expect other people to change? That is what we often do. Yeah, especially often in close relationships, we kind of want to change the other person. And actually, it's not a very good idea. We have to learn to be more accepting, basically, in the way they are. Yeah, and very often that is often when they also have the most opportunity to change, I think, when we are accepting, because that's when they feel cared for, they feel accepted, you know, okay, you're okay the way you are, and then that's when they become a bit, okay, maybe, but otherwise they become kind of, you know, become more resistant very often, so that is very true, yeah, and also you write about the idea that this happens very quickly, yeah, the change, once you just that focus on the good, it kind of just evaporates the kind of the bad quality. But again, you have to get it quickly. And then when it isn't very solidly kind of set yet, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's good. Yes, please.
Advice on when one is struggling to find good qualities in an extremely ignorant person, how do we relate
The Hitlers of the world, okay. Are there many Hitlers in your life? Only one Hitler in your life? Okay, good, I'm glad. Because when you go on the internet, you think there's Hitlers everywhere. Yeah, he's kind of... good. I will come back to this later on, because the brief answer is that when you cannot see any good qualities in someone, you have to have compassion rather than metta. Yeah, so metta is the ability, or love and kindness is the ability to actually see something good in someone, and then you feel friendly towards them. You have a friendly attitude, which is like metta, basically. It's friendliness, goodwill. Can't see anything good? Compassion is the way to go. Because you know that person has a serious problem, right? If they have all bad qualities. I'll come back to this later on. I'm going to go through a sutta that talks about this in quite a bit of detail, and then we'll hopefully sort that out. You go first, because you haven't asked any questions yet.
Have you spoken about how to stop thinking in regard to ill will?
Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit about applying this method to sensuality, specifically the body, if we're trying to let go?
Yeah.
Sensuality, let go of the body.
So if we are talking about things like, you know, sexual fantasies, for example, which is quite common in meditation circles, then if you want to counteract that immediately, straight away, then basically you have to focus on the body in a new way. Yeah, these things usually arise because we see the body as attractive. And this is why one of those kind of early teachings that we find in the Satipatthana Sutta are about seeing the body as 31 parts. They're seeing what the body really is like. This is often used in meditation to overcome kind of those things immediately. And it can work. Some people find this very useful in the meditation. The idea is just to kind of be more realistic about the body. The reason why the body is attractive is, for example, because it is enveloped in skin. Take the skin off, it kind of takes away a lot of the attraction of the body. Yeah. So, and that is kind of the sort of exercise you might do to remove some of the attraction here. Sometimes I think of myself, my own face, without skin here. And that's kind of interesting, yeah, because it changes everything at that moment. It's completely changed the things around her. But these are very tough exercises. It takes a lot of commitment to do these kind of things because they really go against the grain very, very strongly. Yeah. And for a lot of lay people, I would not necessarily recommend these kind of things because it's just too harsh and too kind of contrary to how most people live their life. So the way I normally would think about things is more to kind of think, have a general idea of the sensory world as kind of not interesting and problematic. Because if the whole sensory world is problematic, then that kind of tends to include all the little details in that as well, and you kind of have a general pushing away of that world. And I will come to this later on in quite a bit of detail. But, you know, it's things like just seeing that the world is just out of control. Yeah, this feeling that the world is going, we have no idea where it's heading, we can't really do much about it. And then that rejection of that whole sensory realm, in a sense, as being interesting. Yeah? And knowing that your future is not really in that realm. You know, one of the interesting things that you were seeing a lot of these days is a lot of anxiety and fear, especially maybe in younger generations who are kind of looking at the future and thinking, wow, what's happening with the planet? Where are we going here? And you can't really blame them. But the Buddhist answer to that is very, kind of actually quite simple. The Buddhist answer is that your future does not really depend all that much about what happens in the world outside. It depends a little bit on that, but that's only a small fraction of it. The future actually depends much more on how you live as a person. What are the qualities of your heart? That is where you build your future. Good people have good results. And this is true in this life, and it certainly is true if you take into account things like rebirth, right? And so that means that the world outside of us actually isn't all that interesting. It is out of control. It doesn't really have all that much to do with whether we have a good future or not. It is the inner life that is important. And once you start to kind of get clear about this, actually you start, that whole world outside becomes far less interesting. And then you start to focus on the inner life and the spiritual path, because that is where your future is created. Sometimes when I meditate, I think, I have no future. That's kind of one of my mantras. I have no future. And the idea is not that there is a future, obviously, but there's not a future in the ordinary sense, in the sense of looking at the world outside. Where is the world heading? What is the future in the sensory realm? That is the kind of thing I abandon. And then the future actually is now, is watching the breath, staying in the present. That is where your future is made. And once you get this idea that your future is made by being in the present, by watching the breath, by purifying the mind, if that is where your future is made, that is what becomes interesting. But the reason why we think about the world is because we think, actually, that is where our future is made. I have these problems I've got to sort out. I have these entertainments and things I'm going to do when I come back after this retreat. And because we think our future is there, and that is where we're going to find satisfaction, that is where the mind goes. But the moment you get it, that the future actually is not made there, it is created now by how we sit now, how we watch the breath, how we use our mind, it changes your interest. The mind loses interest in that world outside, and it goes within instead. But this is like more like a macro perspective on things, right? Rather than the micro perspective. And it doesn't, if you have strong desires coming up in the present, they are not really dealt with very efficiently by this kind of macro perspective. If you want to deal with these really with powerful desires in the present, often you have to use more kind of harsher techniques, 31 parts of the body or something like that. And sometimes you just have to wait, wait for these things to pass. They come and go, they fluctuate. Go for a walk or whatever, you come back and you find afterwards something simple. So Anyway, is that helpful at all? Huh? Yeah? Okay, good. We're running out of time a little bit there. Can we, let's take some more questions later on, otherwise it's going to take too long. Yeah, so. Okay, so this is the first way of overcoming unskillful thoughts. Yeah, the idea that you have a kind of a shelf of perceptions in your mind, and you can go into your mind and you can bring down these perceptions, and they counter the negative perception that has arisen in your mind. So if that doesn't work, what do we do next? So one of the important points here, that this is about five different ways of dealing with thoughts. And as always in the suttas, everything is structured in a certain way. It is not random which one comes first and which one comes last. So when there are five ways and this one here is mentioned first, it means that is the most important one. Yeah, that is the one we should try first. Changing our attitude to the object we are dealing with, looking at it in a different way. When that works, it works very rapidly, it's very powerful. So it is there because it is the most powerful technique, and it's the first one we should try. And then, if that doesn't work, then comes the next one. Now suppose that mendicant is focusing on some foundation of meditation, or just whatever, focusing on anything connected with the skillful. Yeah? So in other words, you are doing the previous one, but still, bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion keep coming up. So the first method hasn't worked, in other words. So what do we do when the first method doesn't work? Then they should examine the drawbacks of those thoughts. So these thoughts are unskillful. They are blameworthy. They result in suffering. As they do so, those bad thoughts are given up and come to an end. The mind becomes stilled internally, it settles, unifies, and becomes immersed in samadhi. So here we have the idea which is very similar to the previous sutta we looked at. Yeah, you see the negative aspect in those thoughts. You see that they are unskillful, akusala. And here, of course, unskillful also has the idea that they block you from making progress on the path. That is why they are unskillful. It doesn't lead to any positive outcomes. Yeah, they are blameworthy. They are, in other words, they are negative. Yeah, you kind of blame yourself if you think too much about these things. You think that you are not living up to your Buddhist high standards or whatever. And they result in suffering. This is very much what we saw in the previous sutta. Suffering for yourself, suffering for others, and suffering for both. Yeah. So this is how you reflect. And we already talked about this in quite a bit of detail in the previous sutta. So you know that these things are dangerous. You know that they lead you astray. You know that they go in the opposite direction of the path. You know that every time you have this kind of thought, you're taking one step back instead of a step forward. Yeah, because every time you have a thought that is negative or is unworthy or is wrong, you are laying down kind of tracks in your mind. You're laying down personality traits. You're strengthening that aspect of your personality. Because our personalities are very complex, right? So we have maybe a little bit of ill will and a lot of metta or whatever. But every time you think that ill will, you're strengthening that particular personality aspect and going in the wrong way. And we can't really afford to go backwards on the path, right? Because life is short. Before we know it, it's come to an end. That's why it's good to do a bit of death contemplation so that you kind of remember how short it can be. And then that motivates you to do these kind of things. So this is what you do. And then you have the nice simile here. Suppose there was a woman or a man who was young, youthful, and fond of adornments. If the corpse of a snake or a dog or a human were hung around their neck, they would be horrified, repelled, and disgusted. In the same way, you remember the drawbacks of those thoughts. Yeah, so I don't know, how would you feel if someone kind of put a dead dog, yeah, rotten, kind of falling? Have you seen corpses before of animals? Have you seen animal corpses as they rot? It's fascinating because when you live in the forest like we do, yeah, there are kangaroos that are dying all the time. And then they just lie there and they rot and you see the decomposition happening. Yeah. And it's a disgusting spectacle. Really is disgusting. Yeah. I mean, the smell is absolutely terrible. Yeah. And you get all the maggots coming, right? And it's, after a while, becomes this heaving pile of maggots, right? And it really is awful. So when it talks about having the dead corpse of a dog around your neck, hopefully it isn't too decomposed because that's really disgusting. But I'm just kind of giving you an idea so kind of how bad it can be. And so this is how you should think about those bad thoughts, right? And this again gives you an idea of how often, how far away we are from the way of the Buddha, the way the Buddha thinks. Yeah, because often we enjoy these bad thoughts. Yeah, we especially even ill will. We enjoy a bit of ill will. We enjoy a bit of, yeah, they deserve it. Yeah, they are bad people or whatever. Yeah. And so we get into those thoughts. And actually, what you're doing is you're allowing that dead corpse to hang around your neck. Yeah. That's what you're doing. Yeah. So don't do that. And these are ideas to be cultivated. I mean, when I say these things, I don't mean that you should kind of take this on board on blind faith and say, yeah, this is a corpse around my neck, yeah, get rid of it. That's the stupid way of doing it. The idea here is to use this as a basis for reflection, yeah, to see if you can see this for yourself, how detrimental these things actually are. And so the Buddha is giving you just a little bit of guidance to give you an idea of where this is heading if you understand these things in the right way. Yeah, this is really where we should be at. We should see these things as really, truly dangerous, as blocking your spiritual path. Life is short. Now is the time to overcome these negative thoughts. Not tomorrow, not in 1 second, but now. Yeah, and this kind of brings the urgency of the path kind of into perspective as you do this. So this is the second way, right? This is a bit more... it takes a bit more work than the first way. The first way, you already have the perceptions clear in your mind. You know which perception to use. You have already contemplated the danger in these things. You know the countermeasure that is required to overcome these things, and you just put it into place, and you overcome things. Here, it is a bit more reflective, right? But even here, hopefully, if you have done the reflection beforehand, it will be fairly quick. Yeah, you just want to nudge the mind. Remember, we are already talking about meditation practice here. So if these things come up in your meditation, you don't want to think too much. Because if you think too much in your meditation, you destroy the whole experience. So for that reason, it's a bit more like nudging the mind, a reminder of these perceptions, right? You can see how this can be very subtle sometimes. It is not a large amount of thinking that is required usually here. So that is number two. So what if that doesn't work? So then we come to the next one. Now suppose that the mendicant is examining the drawbacks of those thoughts. Yeah, so you're trying the previous method, but bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion still keep coming up. Yeah, nothing is working for you. Maybe you haven't got enough wisdom yet. Usually that's what happens. You haven't still not got enough wisdom. So we're coming to the more and more kind of basic mind here, perhaps. The more and more, you know, person who hasn't really contemplated these teachings all that much. That's the majority of people, unfortunately. That's how it is. So what should they do? Well, they should try to ignore and forget about those thoughts. As they do so, those bad thoughts are given up and come to an end. The mind becomes stilled internally, it settles, unifies, and becomes immersed in samadhi. So you should forget about those thoughts. You should ignore them. What does that mean in practice? Well, what it means in practice is that, let's say you are watching the breath, and you see a thought coming up, you kind of remember someone did something bad to you. Yeah, they did that towards me. Yeah, they're a bad person. It's always me, 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 right? It's always about a very kind of self-centered thing. And it's natural. You don't feel bad about being self-centered. It's natural that we are a bit self-centered. That's just because the world revolves around each one of us, right? That's the reality of things. So that's okay. So don't treat yourself badly because of that. So then what you do, instead of then kind of buying into it, you say, wait a minute, okay, let's just stay with the breath. Yeah. In other words, you ignore the thought. You kind of leave it into the background or whatever, and you just stay with the breath. So you kind of forget about it. You ignore it and you forget about it. And the Pali words here that for ignoring and forgetting, it's always nice to go back to the Pali a little bit. They are asati and amanasikara. Asati is opposite of sati, yeah? So in other words, that is forgetting. Sati is remembering, asati is forgetting. And amanasikara is the opposite of attending to something. So you don't attend to it. You attend instead to the breath. You stay with the meditation object. That is kind of the idea here. Yeah? You can also use this in daily life, even though this is mostly about meditation. You can use this in daily life as well. You are going about your activities, you're doing your work, and suddenly some intrusive thought comes into your mind while you're doing your work. Okay, focus back on the work again. Whatever that might be. You're doing the vacuuming in your house, right? And suddenly a thought comes up. No, okay, focus on the vacuuming. And it's nice to focus on the vacuuming, right? I mean, it's kind of nice. I haven't vacuumed for a long time, but I do remember in the old days, I had to vacuum the house or whatever. And if you focus on the vacuuming and you make that into a kind of meditation, it's actually quite a nice thing to do. Don't hate the vacuuming, right? If you hate the vacuuming, you're losing an opportunity for doing something good at the same time having a positive mind. Enjoy it. Be mindful. Stay with it. Make it into a kind of vacuuming meditation. So this is kind of a bit one of the sort of weird things about modern Buddhism. Everything is made into a meditation. So it's not really vacuuming meditation, but be mindful and do it in a good way, focusing on the meditation. The bad thought comes up. That's kind of the idea here. Stay with what you're doing. Don't allow yourself to be distracted by these things. That is the third way. Yeah. So one way after the other. And each one takes like less wisdom, less understanding of the path, right? So our idea is to build up the maximum wisdom so we can use the higher type, higher kind of overcoming the unwholesome thoughts. That's kind of the idea here. But you will find that sometimes you have to use the lower ones because the wisdom isn't there. Yeah, some days we are more wise, other days we are less wise. Some days we feel completely stupid. You know that feeling? Sometimes, oh, today I feel so stupid. Everything, nothing is right. Everything is wrong. My mind is completely nuts today. And and then you have to use these kind of lower levels of overcoming these thoughts. So what if this doesn't even work? Yeah, you're not really able to overcome it by ignoring it. It still comes at the back of your mind forcefully, penetrating through your meditation. What is the next thing to do? So now, suppose that a mendicant is ignoring. Actually, I didn't take the simile there. Sorry, I forgot about the simile. Suppose there was a person with good eyesight and some undesirable sights came into the range of vision. They just close their eyes or look away, right? You carry on what you're doing. You don't look at it. You leave it in the background. You don't worry about it. And then hopefully it will disappear. If that doesn't work, then suppose that a mendicant is ignoring and forgetting about those thoughts, but still bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion keep coming up. They should focus on stopping the formation of those thoughts. As they do so, those bad thoughts are given up and come to an end. The mind becomes stilled internally, is settled, unified, and becomes immersed in samadhi. So the formation, stopping the formation of those thoughts, this is one of the more cryptic ones of these ones. What does that actually mean? And the Pali is the vitakka sankara santana. Santana is like the stopping or the calming. Sankara here is the will. Yeah. So the vitakka sankara is the will to think or the will behind the thought, the will that drives the thinking process. So what we're doing here is we're stopping that will, that intention, the volition that drives the thinking process. That's what we're doing here. How do you stop that will? So the way to stop that will is to remember what is the opposite of will. The opposite of will is to be passive, right? Activity is willfulness, passivity is lack of will. So what we do then is we become passive, passive observers of what is going on. That is what you were saying before. Watch the anger, figure it out, become a passive observer, try to see what's happening, right? It's similar to that. And if you are wise, you gain some information at the same time about how the causes work, etc. But here the idea is that if you are completely passive, if you really succeed with this, you are undermining the whole force that keeps this thought in existence. It can only exist when it is driven by the will, driven by volition, driven by intention. And this is kind of strange, right? Because often it feels that thoughts just come into our mind, they're kind of intruding on our meditation or whatever. Are we saying that we actually want to have those thoughts? And of course, the answer is yes, we want to have those thoughts. That is the problem, right? Even though you may not even be able to see that, you may not be able to see the desire or the intention behind them. Whenever we think anything, there is an intention behind that thought. We actually want to have it. And that's kind of unpleasant. Do I really want to have all these thoughts? It's a weird kind of thing because on the one hand we don't want to have them because we're trying to practice a spiritual path, but there's something deeper inside of us that still wants to have those thoughts. So it is almost like there's a clash between the deeper desires and the more idealistic aspects of the mind. Yeah, the higher kind of view and the deeper desires, they clash with each other, and that clash is what we experience sometimes in meditation like this. The mind still is driven by this deeper underlying nature, whereas actually the higher spiritual faculties are not really powerful enough to overcome that deeper aspect of the mind. So we learn to be passive. And this idea of being passive in meditation, you will have noticed also when we talk about meditation, when we do the guided meditation, the idea of being passive and observing is a very important part of this. Because if you do that passivity in ordinary meditation, you are no longer driving the thinking mind. And because you're no longer driving the thinking mind, just as we're seeing here, the thoughts will tend to calm down all by themselves. So passivity is the opposite of the mind being active. So this is what we're doing here, just observing, allowing things to be. And if you observe those thoughts, yeah, it's kind of strange that the moment you observe a thought, it's almost like it starts to disappear anyway. Have you noticed that? Yeah, it can't really deal with the mindfulness. The mindfulness actually kind of tends to stop the thinking mind in its tracks. So just the fact that you become aware and then gradually you turn up the brightness and the light of mindfulness means that the thinking mind has a tendency to calm down and stop. So here we have this simile, yeah, which kind of gives makes this quite clear. Suppose there was a person who was walking quickly, and they would think, why am I walking so quickly? Why don't I slow down? And so they slow down. And they think, why am I walking slowly? Why don't I stand still? So they stand still. Why am I standing still? Why don't I sit down? So they sit down. Why am I sitting down? So they lie down. Yeah. And so that person would reject successively coarser postures and adopt more subtle ones. So, this is the idea. You stand back and you allow the mind to calm down stage by stage. And just as the posture of a person becomes more and more subtle in exactly the same way. This is then the fourth way of overcoming these things. It is the fourth way because it is not super duper powerful. The mind may linger quite a long time on those negative thoughts. And if the underlying defilement is strong, the will, the intention will still be there to think these things, and you may not be able to overcome things in this way. But if nothing else works, this is what you should do. So again, remember, this is the fourth way of doing it. All right, so we're coming towards the end. There's a few minutes left. Does what I'm saying so far, does it make any sense to anyone? Yes, please, at the back there.
going back to the corpse simile that we just talked about.
Yeah.
So, can we use aversion to death in a we're using this aversion to death as a positive aversion, right?
Yeah.
So not all aversion are negative.
It's not really aversion to death that we're doing here. What we are doing is we're just trying to contemplate the reality of death, right? And that's different. So death is not necessarily... So we're trying to see death in such a way that it becomes a positive factor on the path, not actually to have aversion to it. So which one are you thinking about now specifically?
For instance, when you mentioned the dead kangaroo and the maggots.
Right.
But if you look at the reality of that situation,
yeah,
it's actually very beautiful.
Right. Okay,
The aversion comes from a wrong view of death.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's subjective.
Yeah.
You could have aversion to that corpse.
Yeah.
But I could actually see a lot of beauty because the maggots are feeding on food.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Good. Yeah. Sure. Fair enough. So the corpse, not really death as such, but the corpse is really the thing that we have aversion to in this particular case. You don't like. So I know. Okay. Fair enough. What you're saying, I think the idea here is that to just bring to mind that somehow these thoughts are problematic in a very deep kind of sense. So if that doesn't work for you, think of a cesspool maybe. A cesspool is maybe a bit more difficult to see the goodness in, right? So a cesspool, if someone is pushing you to a cesspool, you're about to fall in. Okay, thank you very much, I'd rather not. So something like that, which actually you feel has a negative connotation for you, use that. Say again?
Unless you're a bacteria,
right? So you can always find the positive in anything. So you just the idea is just to find something which, remember the simile here is about an ordinary person, a young woman or a young man. Generally speaking, they won't like the idea of having a corpse hanging around the neck, right? So there are exceptions to that, but generally speaking, they won't like that. So that is kind of the idea. So use the idea of a general person's reaction in that kind of situation. I think that's kind of the point,
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so I think let's call it a morning at this point. I've been a little bit late up from my lunch, so I should probably come up a little bit earlier. So again, please carry on meditating as you see fit. And then we will see you back again at 2 o'clock in the this afternoon. And in the meantime, please have a nice lunch, etc., etc. So, okay, good.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.